Toward it. So it's been almost one full year since my time at Tassajara, and it has taken at least that long to process the experience for me, and I was kind of grappling, trying to think about what to talk about during my Dharma talk, you know, what is the question that's arising most powerfully for me? And while I've done quite a bit of studying, especially of koans during the practice period, and recently at a meeting of teachers to talk about death koans, I guess the question that is most present for me in my spiritual practice is still this time that I spent at a practice period in Tassajara. You'll have to forgive me. I'm not sure how long my talk is. My computer decided to go into early retirement. And so I had a draft on my computer, and then my computer wouldn't turn on, or it would turn on, but there's no image on the screen. And so I had to recreate it and then write it all out by hand. So I really don't have an idea of how long this is. So it might be really short, and then we can have time for a question period afterwards, or it might be long and everybody will be falling asleep and tapping their fingers. So I was at Tassajara Zen Monastery for the winter 2017 practice period. And I know a few of you have been there. I know Dan, Kate, anybody else? Do you know? No. So it's one of the practice centers of the San Francisco Zen Center, associated with the San Francisco Zen Center. I went there at the request of my teacher. So as part of my ordination, he requested that I attend a practice period at Tassajara, among other things. So I'm still processing the experience, and I realize in giving this talk that there are all sorts of things that I haven't been able to put into this Dharma talk, like a detailed description of the miraculous and wonderful and life-saving hot springs, Tassajara hot springs, or the wonderful hikes, or the wildflowers in spring, or all of the different types of work that I did, or the wonderful people, some of the wonderful people I met, and the bats flying past my head when I was ringing the big densho bell after a day of zazen, and it was the full moon. There's so many little vignettes that I have, little mental postcards of my time there. But first, I'll give you the Coles Notes version of my experience. I really found that it was most beautifully and accurately expressed in this koan called Chiono's No Water, No Moon. It's from this book, The Hidden Lamp. Chiono was a servant in a Zen convent who wanted to practice zazen. One day she approached an elderly nun and asked, "I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write and must work all the time. Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of Buddha even though I have no skills?" The nun answered her, "This is wonderful, my dear. In Buddhism there are no distinctions between people. There is only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. People are complete as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There's only one complete nature. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. This is called zazen." Chiono said with happiness, "With this practice as my companion, I have only to go about my daily life, practicing day and night." After months of wholehearted practice, she went out on a full moon night to draw some water from the well. The bottom of her old bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way, and the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. When she saw this, she attained great realization. Her enlightenment poem was this: "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out." Where the moon does not collect, or where the water does not collect, the moon does not dwell. So a practice period at Tassajara is a 90-day period of intensive practice whose central focus is the daily sitting schedule. You're often reminded to just follow the schedule. Everything revolves around the schedule. Students are required to attend every single sitting period. And if you're not able to attend because you're sick, you have to sign a pad of paper to say why you're away. If not, the Tenkan or timekeeper will come and get you. And there are a couple of funny tales about that. But everything is sort of interspersed with the periods of sitting. Every single service, every meal, every work meeting, and every community meeting. The usual daily wake-up bell begins at 3:50 a.m., and we sit until 9 p.m. This is interspersed with the services, meals, study period, work periods, and bath time. But except for periodic work days and personal free days, it's pretty much the same. Even on the work days and free days, there's still zazen and a schedule and services in the zendo. There are one-week sesshin, or more intensive retreats, at the end of every month. So there was one at the end of January, one at the end of February, one at the end of March, which have no study or work periods. They just have more sitting periods. For first-time students at Tassajara, the practice period begins with 5 days of sitting without bells, without kinhin, or walking meditation, and with only half-hour breaks after each of the three meals. So that's the basic structure of activities. But you may be wondering what the physical environment is like. You may have heard me talk about the rain and the cold that I experienced when I was there, as this was one of the predominant experiences for most students during this practice period. According to one of the teachers who'd lived there since the 1970s, she said that there was only one other time in the 70s, it was, that there was this much rain and flooding. So it was pretty intense. To begin, though, let me describe the setting. The monastery is located southeast of San Francisco. You drive south from the city for a couple of hours until you get to Carmel, and then you head east, or inland. The monastery is about 1.5 hours drive from the highway over an ever-narrowing road, which eventually is just a single-lane dirt and gravel road that winds up and down and around the mountains. Tassajara is at the bottom of a valley surrounded by mountains, with both Tassajara Creek and Cabargo Creek running through it. As you can imagine, it's quite beautiful and scenic, and so far from other human settlements that it can be very quiet. When it's clear, the sky is an almost unbelievably intense turquoise blue. But the stars at night were even more unbelievable. In fact, there were times when it felt like there were more stars than darkness in the sky. So January 4th, the day we arrived, was absolutely beautiful. Sunny, relatively warm, and I thought, yeah, I can do this, no problem. 90 days, I'm good. The next day, though, it started to rain, and rain and storm, and it was pretty much like that for the next 2 months. The dirt paths became mud pits that would suck the boots off your feet, quite literally. The creeks ran exceptionally high and extremely fast. Sitting in the zendo, we would sometimes hear the boulders being knocked about by the currents or knocked downstream. I experienced what I think were auditory illusions caused by the sounds of the water, first Tibetan monks chanting, then Latin music, then punk rock, then voices. It was pretty interesting to observe. So I guess it was quiet because we were far from human settlement, but at no time did the sound of the stream stop. So that was a constant. Aside from distraction and inconvenience, though, the weather posed danger, actual physical danger. As debris from previous forest fires was swept down the creek, it would dam up at certain points in the creek and create floods. It wiped out a pedestrian bridge that was used to access the emergency helipad. Several people had to move out of their cabins for a time because they were in danger of flooding. And one monk, who was the he's the physical plant manager, his name is Kogan, just about drowned trying to clear some debris in the creek. There was a major washout along the road which made it impassable to vehicular traffic, including emergency vehicles. Two landslides, one of which sent boulders as big as cars across the road, took place about 1.5 miles from the camp. And I can tell you that I bore witness to the boulders, and they were about as big as Kate and Michael's Honda Fit, some of them. It was staggering. So these conditions, plus the cold, emphasized the feeling and the reality of the monastery's isolation. It really clarified how we 60 people really depended upon each other for pretty much everything. If you thought sticking to a rigorous practice schedule was enough of a challenge, this just added to the intensity. Not surprisingly, feelings would often run quite high, and some relationships had an edge to them which might not have been found in other circumstances. Some people's irritation became quite clear. Others reverted to a sort of high school cliquishness. Some people got on my nerves, although I could often work to clarify things with some gentle inquiry. But there were at least three people who quite actively and overtly disliked me. It was pretty interesting. Given the conditions, perhaps all of the interpersonal turmoil is not surprising. I perhaps found it more challenging because I had brought along with me to the monastery a preconceived notion of how the monastery would be. I thought it would be a kind of university of Zen, where I'd sit at the feet of great bodhisattvas, highly practiced monks, whose great equanimity and compassion would inspire me to emulate them. What I found, though, was a place with people, or where people who are suffering just as much as people are suffering outside the monastery gates. This includes myself, a 20-year veteran of Zen practice, seeing so very clearly some of the narratives that I constantly construct around myself, and how I plug people's behaviors, however innocent, into a view I have of myself. Perhaps one of my views is that I'm an outsider. And it's a narrative that perpetuates all kind of suffering, and one that became very, very clear to me when I was there. I also learned, however, that with a lot of courage and a sense of little to lose, there were certain people I could ask or there were people I could ask about their actions, and more often than not, found that they were simply distracted by something else. At best, though, I sometimes felt comfortable enough to reveal the narrative I'd been creating for myself. The more I experimented with this type of vulnerability, the closer I began to feel to people. The process, which I allowed to happen over and over, of opening myself and not assuming anything about the reasons behind the actions of others, brought me greater peace, maybe even greater happiness and compassion, and hopefully greater peace to the people around me. About halfway through the practice period, I began to receive some training in how to lay out a zagu, how to put on robes, how to eat with the priest's orioki bowls, and how to conduct a service. I was also invited to join Kosho Valerie Beer, a senior teacher from San Francisco Zen Center, to teach rakusu sewing. I was deeply honored by this, as she was the teacher who came up to Bellingham to help Tim, Michael, and Chris Burkhart cut out and begin sewing their new okesas, and also to teach me how to sew sanmatsu bags. So these are little silk brocade bags that hold lineage papers. Towards the end of February, there was less rain, more sunshine, and more warmth, which was very good for doing laundry, which was all done by hand and hung out on the line. I, along with my fellow first-time monks, who are known as Tongariyo students, were really getting the hang of all the special jobs that only the first-timers get to do. One of the big jobs is serving the orioki meals, which is an incredibly ornate, precise, and choreographed event with seemingly endless opportunities to make mistakes. When it goes well, though, it is an absolutely beautiful ritual in which to participate. I was also appreciating how the peace acquired by long, regular meditation created a fertile ground to study, to deeply study the Dharma. I chose to study Dogen more deeply, as well as ideas about Zen ritual. My Dogen studies were enriched with the Dogen study group, which met after dinner on every personal day. It was a mix of reading aloud from one of Dogen's fascicles, sharing our personal response to it, sharing whatever other context we might have, and sometimes supplemented by the group facilitator's even more in-depth research on the text. The facilitator commented to me on the ease with which I engaged in this type of study, and I replied that I had had a lot of practice in my Sangha back home. As I spoke to other monks at Tassajara, I found many were going home to where they either didn't have a Sangha, or where the Sangha just met briefly for sitting and then dispersed, or where maybe they just had a sitting group of four or five people. I came to realize how incredibly fortunate we are, and I am, to have our mountain rain Sangha, and the many creative and active ways we have of sharing the Dharma. And I'm grateful, of course, to Kate and Michael for all of the energy that you've put into this. So we are perhaps much more lucky than you realize. Like many others at the practice period, I had many moments where I desperately wanted to pack up and get out. I even talked to teachers about this and other people. I found many edges in my practices. Some people call them points where I had to either figure out the bodhisattva path to working through difficulty or running away screaming. It was hard work. There were times when I'd struggle through issues in Dokusan, other times when I'd call my sister in Sacramento and cry until she determined that she was going to drive straight down and pick me up. Other times when a long soak in the beautiful hot springs baths was just enough to get me through to the next day. And of course, like Chiyono, there were times when the bottom of the bucket just broke. The water ran out, and all I could do was sit on my cushion, not believing anything or anyone, just knowing that this practice has helped me and it's helped the world in many ways. And I don't know how all the time, and I don't know if what's going on around me is actually creating that. And all I could do is sit there and say, I take refuge in Buddha. I take refuge in Dharma. I take refuge in Sangha. So it was not so much like giving up, but letting go. Not trying to find a reason or formulate a plan, but just opening my mind to wonder, to what Suzuki Roshi calls beginner's mind. It was a sense of just allowing my life to be one moment after the other, because there was nothing else I could do except maybe pack up my things and walk out. And just being entirely curious about whatever I was experiencing, knowing that the next moment would bring something else. It was also a return to the refuge of the body and the posture of Zazen. Sitting in this state of open-handedness and not knowing what would happen next, and I truly felt like it was not me who did Zazen, but this body. In Kodo Merrill Boyd's reflection on Chiyono's koan, so each of these koans has a reflection by a Zen teacher, based on their own experience. She says that as Zen students, we live between the first two lines of the koan. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. And then the second two lines, where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell. In some circumstances, we know how to keep things together. We know how to get along with people. We know how to take care of our lives, and we know how to get things done. It's useful to have certain areas of competence as we go through our day-to-day lives. Confronted with a harsh environment, challenging interpersonal dynamics, unrealized expectations, and of course, dissipated cognitive functions due to a lack of sleep, this bucket of competencies which holds our so-called life and identity, can fall apart. Page 7 is missing. No. Yeah, it's not here.
Just when the bundle falls apart.
Okay, wait, it's not there. Okay, so, I think what I was going to talk about was, or just bring up was, some of Merle Kodo's commentary. So she comments that our liberation deepens with the refinement of our capacity for flexibility and discernment. The one who is liberated must be allowed to disappear, like the water and the moon. Moving between patched bucket and bottomless bucket, I can exercise my freedom to keep things together or let things come apart according to the circumstances. I have come to trust the true freedom of living where the moon does not dwell. So I think I'll end there. I'm not sure. Let's see. What time am I supposed to end?
This is perfect.
This is perfect. Wow. Good thing I lost page 7.
Anyway,